So why is it that I have a sweet tooth? Why is it that I'm reaching for sweets when ultimately my body is trying to steer me in a healthy way so I can live long and reproduce? Why am I addicted to this?
For the same reason that 91% of Americans and more than 80% of the world are overfat, because somebody has told us this is what we should eat, and people just blindly follow that. We have been fed such a lie with words like natural. Oh, this product is natural. Well, why is there an ingredient list this long? And I can't really pronounce many of the words.
Congratulations, you are at the starting line of Trail Runner Nation. This is a podcast that is dedicated to helping you become a better runner and a better human being by discussions from great guests that impart their invaluable wisdom.
And today's great guest is a repeat Dr. Phil Maffetone, and we always love talking to him. And we're going to break down whether an athlete can be fit and unhealthy at the same time. Scott, I think our podcast needs to subscribe to Native Deodorant, because sometimes our shows really stink, and I think it can help us.
With Native, you don't have to stink. Native cares about the products you put on your body, and they want to make sure that you don't stink the right way.
You probably already know about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant, but have you tried their body wash, toothpaste, and their new mineral-based sunscreen?
Native's on a mission to overhaul your entire hygiene routine by putting the care into self-care with products carefully made to work against odor and that are made of simple ingredients that smell great.
Speaking of smelling great, the new oat milk latte, matcha and sweet cream, Earl Grey and mulberry, and cherry and vanilla macaroon. These are items you can rub on your body, Scott.
And starting at the end of this month through the end of the year, so starting at the end of September through the end of the year, they have their new fall coffee house collection. You can get all of that by going to nativedo.com/trail and use the promo code trail at checkout for 20% off your first order.
On this podcast with Dr. Phil Maffetone, we're going to talk about nutrition. And when I think nutrition, I think about Athletic Greens and the product AG1.
One tasty scoop of AG1 contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, including multivitamins, multiminerals, probiotics, green superfood blends, and more in one convenient daily serving.
So whether you're looking to improve your energy, your immunity, digestion and absorption, nervous system, hormone health, your performance and recovery, AG1 is the answer.
Don and I have been playing around with this stuff for probably about 2 months now, and it tastes great, and it makes you feel better. It helps you recover more. And to make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you an immune-supporting free one-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase if you go to athleticgreens.com/trailrunnernation today. That's athleticgreens.com/trailrunnernation. Or you can go to our deals page and just click on the link. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And today we are back with one of our favorite guests. I think this may be magic number 12, his 12th time that he's been on the podcast. I don't know if you knew that, Dr. Phil. This is Dr. Phil Maffetone. He is one of our favorite guests because I think he's helped me personally in my health and fitness more than any other person we've had on the podcast. He's written, I think, 12 books. Is that right, Phil?
I don't count. They say after 12 or some number, you don't have to count anymore. But I know it's over 20. But who's counting?
Apparently not Scott.
And two. No, I tried. And two books that you have to have in your running library. If you've been listening to Trail Runner Nation for any amount of time, you probably do. If you're new to Trail Runner Nation, you need to get these two books. They need to be a reference in your library. That is The Big Book of Endurance Training and Racing, which is a big yellow book, and the predecessor to that, The Big Book of Health and Fitness, which is about the same size, but it's red. And those are kind of the basis of today's discussion. health and fitness, which comes first, chicken or the egg? Can you be healthy and unfit? Or better question, can you be fit and unhealthy? Dr. Phil, thanks for coming back and spending time with Don and myself and the listeners.
Scott and Don, thanks. My pleasure, as usual. I would not have guessed 12. Time flies when you're having fun. No doubt. I mean, this is like therapy for me. We laugh about, it's fun. And it's the thing that a lot of people, a lot of runners miss in what they're doing. It's got to be fun. You see some of these people running out there in the woods, and you just want to stop them and say, "Can you go home? You're not enjoying this. What are you doing?" We get caught up in counting the miles, and I gotta run 5 times a week, and I gotta run 100 miles a week if I'm gonna run a marathon. And you don't have to do anything. You just have to have fun.
And learn to listen to your body and learn to tune in and hear what it's telling you. Sometimes when you think I should slow down or maybe I should skip a workout, but you look at your spreadsheet and you say, I've got to go. If you're that type of personality, I've got to go. Well, maybe the best advice is that internal coach yourself to back off and give it a day so you can keep it fun. It's hard to have fun when you're just driving and trying to fill out a spreadsheet.
Yeah. And it's just not having fun, that's certainly important. But when you drive yourself, when you follow your spreadsheet, you run the risk of improving your fitness at the expense of your health. And that's the topic you want to talk about. And it was evident for me when I was still a student. Injuries, it's an injury. What does that mean? We did something wrong. What is it? And eventually you say, oh, they're preventable. If they're preventable, then we did something wrong. We didn't prevent the injury. It's not destiny. The heavens come down with a lightning bolt and strike one of our knees because we're runners. It doesn't work that way. We caused it.
There are many t-shirts and bumper stickers. I've seen it on social media posts, Dr. Phil, that says, I can eat anything I want because I'm running 5 days a week, or I run so that I can eat whatever I want. And what do you say to something like that?
Wow, that is one of the earliest questions that I when I started lecturing way back in the 70s, and it was a big part of the running boom. People would say, I'm going to have a second dessert, and I'll just run an extra mile tomorrow. I mean, that's called stupidity. We have this amazing brain that we have to use as a human being, not even talking about being a runner. But certainly, if you use your brain as a runner, you're going to be more successful, because this is where it all starts. That first step starts here. The idea that, hey, I'm getting a little tired now, and maybe I should take the trail to the right and head back rather than that extra 40 minutes of running. We have instincts, we have intuition, and those are the things that really can help us. And from a competitive standpoint, help us where a lot of our competitors are not doing that, because not a lot of people do. But it was the classic question is, so-and-so runs a 30-minute 10K and he eats a lot of junk. And, what's that all about? And what do you say to that? And what I would always say is, well, how much faster could he be running if he ate healthy? I mean, that's really the answer. The food we eat, influences so many things, and we cannot ignore it. In fact, some of the research I was involved with, and some new research, which will be very interesting, coming out quite soon, confirms what we know clinically, what I've known clinically from the beginning. Our food intake, the foods we eat, kind of oversee the exercise part. So exercise, sort of the quality of exercise, is really based on the foods we eat. And if we eat well, we get more out of our training, and we have more of the raw materials that we might need to prevent an injury. The whole fat burning thing, and what does food do to our energy supply? Well, if we eat right, we basically have unlimited energy, because we're now tapping into our fat burning mechanism, and our body fat, even the leanest of us, has hundreds of miles worth of energy sitting there waiting. Of course, when that doesn't happen, we accumulate that body fat. And so if your body fat is too high, it's an injury. It's a biochemical injury. It's a metabolic injury that we need to fix. And it's also an example of trying to be fit, but being unhealthy at the same time.
Dr. Phil, you sent over your article that you wrote a few years back called Athletes Fit But Unhealthy? In the very beginning of the article, which helped me a lot, and I thought maybe we could do it on this episode so that we can all start thinking along these lines using these terms. Can you define fit and also define healthy?
Yeah, this was an early sort of a philosophical thing for me, which began when I was still a student, and then I kind of started understanding it when I got into practice. And then when I ran it was the 1980 New York City Marathon, and I really had a hard time. I kind of bonked, and because I went out too fast, it was very exciting. I don't know if you've ever run New York. It's like a celebration and you want to just dance, and you know, you can't do that. And I crossed the finish line and I was taken to the medical tent, and I woke up a little while later and these people were groaning on the cots and ambulances coming and dropping people off. And I thought this is not healthy. And, but I had become fit enough to run 26.2 miles. Big deal. Okay. That's nice. And the definitions really solidified at that point. And so I sort of finally answered the questions on health versus fitness, or health and fitness, that I was asking myself for a few years. You know, the problem is we have this idea, this old idea, which is, you know, well described in medicine, that health is without having presence of disease. And you can expand that and say, well, health must be, you know, lacking signs and symptoms. No, it doesn't work that way. Health is a state where all the systems of the body, the nervous system, the digestive system, hormones, everything is working in some kind of harmony. And we sort of say, well, ideally we want this perfect balance. We'd never reach it, but we can keep striving for it. And fitness is different. Fitness is the ability to be athletic. So if you're a 32-minute 10K runner, you're more fit than someone who runs 33 minutes, at least for that day. And your fitness moves around. And we can always strive to be more fit. We can always build our fitness in different ways. And they both go together. We need both from a standpoint of competition, for example. We need to be healthy, because if we're not, then we're injured. And that injury can be a physical injury, but it can be a biochemical injury or a metabolic injury, like I mentioned, or it could be a mental, emotional injury, you know. And when you're injured, you can't perform, you can't be as fit, no matter what your training is all about. So that balance is really, it's what you learn in kindergarten as an athlete. It should be the first and foremost thing that is always there. Am I maintaining this balance? And that means we eat right. It means we train right. It means we deal with the stress factors in our lives as best we can. And then our natural stress mechanism will adapt well.
I have so many questions already, Phil. First one is, if someone's listening to this and they're unfit and they're unhealthy and they want to make a change, should they focus on one before the other?
Not only that, they should only focus on one thing, because, and studies show this as well. And I learned it the hard way in practice. You know, I would get so excited about, okay, let me show you the blood tests. This is what's going on with you, and dietary recommendations, and then start exercise recommendations. And then let's look at your stress. You got these physical stresses. You're sitting too much. You got these, you know, and then you don't see them again because they're overwhelmed. Where do I start? What do I do? This is insane. What the studies show is that when you make recommendations for people, unless you stick with one or two, you're done. You're not going to go anywhere. So I kind of play the, I've learned to play this game with an individual person who I've evaluated. And, okay, they have all these things, signs and symptoms, what's causing what. And you kind of work your way up to a high-level priority. So this one thing causes these 10 things, which is causing these 45 things. Obviously, you don't want to work on one of those 45 things at a time, because now you're treating symptoms. Mm-hmm. So you want to treat the cause. And it varies from person to person. So it's very individual. However, like I said earlier, one's diet really has a primary effect on exercise directly. And so for most people, if you're listening for the first time and you don't know where to begin, do one thing. Stop eating junk food. That's all. Things will start getting better quickly. If you have excess body fat, you'll start losing it quickly. And then you can start walking a little bit. And some people who have not been working out or eating well should not exercise, because they can hurt themselves. They can kill themselves. You know, it's really, some of the case studies out there are just, gosh, they're just devastating to read.
So Scott brought that question up before the podcast, and he and I were speaking about it, and I just learned something. I went the other direction. I said, hey, Scott, that's an easy one. It turns out absolutely wrong. I was wrong. I thought we were going to turn the dials slowly together and move them equally. But listening to what you just said, what I learned was you can't ask people to do too much. People that need to improve their diet first and foremost need to improve that so that they'll feel like exercising. And that will help move them and push them forward, and the outcomes are better. So, Scott, I was wrong, and I've been called out on the show by myself.
You're right. In terms of what you said about they'll feel better and they'll feel like exercising, that's a big problem. Getting somebody to exercise who has not been exercising is a real tough challenge for me when I'm sitting in front of a patient saying, you know, you need to exercise. You know, get them feeling better. It's hard enough to get them to change, but if they've already decided they're going to change, okay, let's do one thing, only one thing. And a lot of times when I lecture, and I've done this with doctors, we'll talk about those 45 signs and symptoms, you know, and how confusing it can get. It's part of doing history. How do you figure somebody out? Well, you've got signs and symptoms, so that's a good place to start, because these are clearly what the patient's complaining about. You know, I'm tired, my knee hurts, whatever. Okay, and then you kind of work your way up to the contributing factors and eventually to the cause or causes. And that's the one thing. And in the case of food, it is more often than not the primary factor. And if you don't have a metabolism where you can access your body fat as an energy source, how are you going to work out? And yeah, you can't have fun doing that if you've got limited energy from your glycogen stores.
I have another question. So let's say that you are out there and you are putting in 3, 4, whatever, many days, many hours running, and you feel like you're improving your fitness slowly and surely. How do we know if we're healthy or not? Are there, there's the pinch the inch, you know, grab your waist and see how much extra body fat you have. But is there a way to easily determine whether we're healthy, even though we may be out there performing well fitness-wise?
I think there's a number of things we can do. We can look at signs and symptoms. You know, so if I'm fatigued, if I have a lot of intestinal bloating, if I'm not sleeping well, it means something is wrong. It means we need to improve our health and improve our fitness. If we're trying to break a certain time and a certain distance in a race and we haven't been able to do it, then we're lacking in fitness and we need to figure out how to move that forward. So a lot of it comes down to signs and symptoms, because they're the easiest thing to grasp. And also, what's nice about signs and symptoms is they're indicators that things are working or not working. So if we have all, you know, and when I recommend the 2-week test, for example, which is a food challenge where we eliminate junk food for 2 weeks and we monitor our signs and symptoms. If you have these 10 big complaints, you know, fatigue, knee pain, back pain in the morning. You know, you wake up at 2 a.m. And you're unable to get back to sleep and whatever. And, you know, you do this 2-week test and halfway through, a lot of those things disappear. Then you know you're on the right track. So it's a real simple thing to assess. And when you start seeing those things get better, and sometimes in 2 weeks of not eating junk food, it's like a miracle. This is like another person. And I've seen people come in my office after 2 weeks and I wasn't sure, is this his brother that's coming in to beat me up or something? I don't.
Where do we find this 2-week test? Do you have it stored somewhere where we can go retrieve it and take it ourselves?
Yes, it's in both of the books you mentioned. It's on my website. There's a vegetarian 2-week test, which I did about a year ago, maybe. And it's really been one of the really important assessment tools that I used myself in the clinic when I was working with patients. And then writing about it, I can't tell you how many people I've heard from who did the 2-week test. There was a woman who was a few years ago. She wanted to buy exercise shoes because she thought if she bought exercise shoes, she'd exercise. She stumbled on an article on shoes that I had written, and she's looking at it, and then she kind of starts looking around the website, finds the 2-week test, reads it, and she said, oh, that's me. I'm really carbohydrate intolerant. She was very obese. And she did the 2-week test, and she lost like 30 pounds. And then in the next year, she lost half her body weight.
Wow.
This is a way to personalize our food intake. How do we know what to eat? How do we know how much to eat? Do the 2-week test. That's the first step. And then you become more intuitive. Your instincts come about, and it changes a whole lot of what's going on in your world. And you could better battle the marketing things that you're hit with. You know, fat is bad. We're glucose-based animals. If you're a runner, you need a lot of glucose. So we eat a lot of our energy bars. You know, just a lot of the bad stuff out there that has caused our society to get as sick as it is. You know, in the study I did on the U.S., prevalence of overfat, I found 91% of adults were overfat. Come on, there's something wrong here. Where does that come from? It comes from the junk food, and it comes primarily from the refined carbohydrates, including sugar.
Can I ask you a question about that, Dr. Phil? If I'm listening to this, refined carbohydrates, what does it do to me? Why is it so bad? Why does it drive a 2-week test the wrong direction?
A number of reasons. For one, eating carbohydrates affects your metabolism immediately. As you start to eat those things, your brain is informed what's coming in. Oh, you got all this junk coming in. We're going to have to change our metabolism. One of the things that happens is you turn off your fat burning. Half the carbohydrates you eat turn to fat. So this whole idea of low, I'm going to eat low fat. That means for most people, they're not going to eat any fat, which means they're going to eat more carbohydrate. And almost all the carbohydrate that's available in the world today is refined, and it turns to sugar as soon as we eat it. That's a problem. And so we've got carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. We got to see, okay, what do I need to eat? So I need 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. Let me see. And you know, you go crazy. And when you do start playing around with your protein, it takes a while for it to change metabolism. And the same with fat, it takes a while. With carbohydrate, it changes your metabolism instantly.
Wow.
And after two meals, after there's something called the second meal effect with carbohydrate consumption. After your second meal, it's enough time to dramatically change your metabolism so that here you are over here eating all this carbohydrate, whether you're exercising or not. You're not burning a lot of fat. You're burning a lot of sugar. You're storing fat. In fact, you're dumping out too much insulin, which is impairing fat burning. It keeps the fat in storage, and all that happens is you add to it.
And Dr. Phil, that makes total sense, because if I'm onboarding a ton of calories again in a carbohydrate form, simple sugar breaks down quickly, and you're looking at the body, it has a mess on its hands. It has a lot of energy that's available. Why would it keep running a fat-burning system when it already has too much energy on board anyway, and it's trying to shove it as far as it can back into a storage fat. It's trying to figure out what to do without spiking your blood sugar too much and causing chaos because the body's trying to stay balanced. And so being very quick acting to this sudden surge of these simple sugars, it makes sense that it only takes one meal or two to change everything so rapidly and takes longer for the other process of fat and protein.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's very logical. And there are a lot of different things that happen in that 2 week period. And in the coming months, in terms of metabolic changes, we have taste buds and sweet tooth and this whole addiction factor. People are typically addicted to sugar. And so after two meals, their metabolism starts changing. After 3 days, their metabolism really solidifies, and now they're burning a lot of fat. After a week, they've kind of gone through the initial phases of sugar addiction, and they're aware of it, and their taste buds start to change, and they say, wow, this thing is sweet. Have I been eating this all along? And then your fat burning starts improving, and your fat burning may continue to improve for a month or two or three. This is the adaptation that people talk about who go on a low carbohydrate, high fat diet. They say, you know, you going into ketosis, now you have to adapt. How long does it take to adapt? It takes 1, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, maybe 2 months, maybe three. The studies that we've done, we're using a month now, and most people change in a month. But, you know, there's always this lingering thing. And in my case, I was a junkie. I was a sugar junkie from the day I was born because they gave me sugar water. And I ate sugar every day for 18 years because I was dumbed down from the sugar and I couldn't think. And then I started realizing what was going on, and that led to changes. But I went through this period. Finally, the cravings went away. Finally, the sweet tooth went away. Foods that I thought were not that sweet were horribly sweet, and I just couldn't even smell them. But there was the bakery effect. And the bakery effect took a number of years. This is how powerful sugar is. The bakery effect is where you walk by a bakery and you smell those things they're making. And you look in the window and you see them right there. They're right there. You can break the glass, or maybe they're open. I'll go in. That continued for years, literally. And it took a long time to where when I smelled something in a bakery, it was just disgusting. Hmm. And so it's not just an emotional memory that you have. There's a physiological effect. And I've got an article on my website called Sugar Addiction, or it might be called something like that. Sugar Addiction, is sugar really addicting? And it talks about how sugar is associated with these certain signs and symptoms. You're in a grocery store and your blood sugar is getting down, and you see a big box of cookies and you grab and you rip the top off and eat the whole thing. The addiction is real. And if you look at the signs and symptoms and then compare it to cocaine or heroin addiction, you see a lot of similar things. And it's just a matter of time when the mental health people who make up all these definitions say, yeah, because now they have added, finally, food addiction. So that's like the last step before they say, yeah, well, the food addiction is kind of a sugar addiction. So we're going to put, but it'll be a while. But that article I wrote is about all those related things that happen, you know, how it affects our dopamine system in the brain, of course, the memories. But the taste buds, our taste buds change. You know, people say, well, I don't understand. My kids won't eat vegetables. How can I get them to eat vegetables? Stop them from eating sugar. Their taste buds will change. Because when your taste buds are really booming with sweetness, the taste buds you have for bitter foods are suppressed. So now you put something a little piece of bitter food in your mouth and it tastes disgusting. You get off the sugar and your sweet taste, your taste buds change for sweetness. And now you taste the taste of coffee. You know, what a great, that bitterness, it's so great. But until then, you have to put sugar in your coffee because it's too bitter.
Are there good carbs? Like I'm thinking oatmeal or whole wheat bread or even like whole wheat sourdough bread that has a natural yeast. Are any of those good or should we steer clear of those as well?
Most of those are junk food. We have been fed such a lie with words like natural. Oh, this product is natural. Well, why is there an ingredient list this long? And I can't really pronounce many of the words on this. Whole wheat bread. Come on. We're talking about processed food here. So most people don't even know what wheat berries are. But for most people, if you buy wheat berries and prepare them somehow, they won't eat them because they're these little dense things. That's what comes off the wheat, you know, off the plant. And then they say, well, you know, the Bible talks about bread. We should be eating bread because the Bible can't be wrong. If you tasted the bread they had 2,000 years ago, you'd vomit. I mean, you couldn't eat that.
Well, that's old bread, Phil. That's old bread. Who would want to eat 2,000-year-old bread?
It's moldy. So I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but, you know, during the pandemic and even before that, I was kind of a sourdough aficionado. And sourdough is water, flour, and really that's it, and the starter. I mean, very low processed, I would say.
Yeah, the problem is the flour. Where does that flour come from? And how many years ago did it begin?
Got it.
You know, when a company says, well, we're going to make this stuff and we need to have a long shelf life. We want to make a lot of it at one time because it's cheap and we'll put it in a package and the package will be on, you know, you could put it in your air raid shelter because it'll be good for years and years because we've taken out all the stuff that goes bad, which happens to be all the stuff that's healthy. And the same with oatmeal. I mean, we have this idea that certain foods are good like oatmeal because it's oatmeal. But if you buy oatmeal and you can cook it by adding boiling water, that's highly processed. And then the other ones, it's like, oh, well, this mine, it takes 5 minutes to cook. Well, that's highly processed. How long does it really take to cook, some oatmeal? It takes about 45 minutes.
Yeah, but Dr. Maffetone, steel cut.
Steel cut, yes.
That's got to be healthy. It's got to be healthy.
It sounds healthy, I think. I don't know.
We're going to take a short break from our discussion with Dr. Phil Maffetone to talk about Socktober, Don.
What is Socktober, Scott?
Socktober is the ingenious marketing plan that our friends at Exoskin have come up with. They want to make sure that as you're going into the fall, that you're covered with socks and sleeves.
There's nothing better than pulling on a new pair of socks and pulling up a set of sleeves to keep you comfortable on those fall days when you're running out there. In Socktober, everybody gets a discount. Everybody with a code or no code, the discount is built in.
Go to exoskin.us. All of their discounts are already built into the socks and sleeves. The code that we have, the discount code, is still available for all the other stuff besides the sleeves and the socks. That code is TRN, and you'll get 15% off the rest of your order. Go to exoskin.us, or you can just go to our deals page and click on the link.
And now, back to the show with Dr. Phil Maffetone. So I have a question. I kind of like the paradigm that our body knows best. And if we listen to our body, that it will lead us in the right direction. So I feel like I've been duped here a little bit. And I like to think about things anthropologically. You know, how did we evolve? What sets us up for success so that we can live and prosper, reproduce, and keep our species going? So that's kind of the paradigm that I'm coming from. So why is it that I have a sweet tooth? Why is it that I'm reaching for sweets when ultimately my body is trying to steer me in a healthy way so I can live long and reproduce? Why am I addicted to this?
For the same reason that 91% of Americans and more than 80% of the world adults are overfat. Because somebody, big industry, has told us this is what we should eat. And people just blindly follow that. What did our ancestors eat? What did the early humans eat? How did they get to be these scrawny little humans, and they suddenly developed a big brain, proportionally bigger than any other animal on Earth. How do we develop longevity and an immune system that resists viruses and bacteria and other microbes? How did we do that? We ate a lot of fat. Bottom line, we ate a lot of fat. We had relatively moderate amounts of protein. And there's a lot of good evidence about that. And I've published those statements. And you know, nobody in the scientific community has a problem with those ideas. So the question that you want to really ask is, where did we go wrong? And we went wrong in the agricultural revolution, because we started processing food. So the first junk food came from the agriculture changes, this agricultural revolution. It was the junk food revolution. Junk food was born, and we had people got to taste things different and started driving their desires for certain foods and long shelf lives, cheap food. And we have that today. The problem with junk food is it's cheap, even though eating natural food is not more expensive. It's available everywhere. And I'm not talking about in the U.S. It's available everywhere in the world. And I've been all over the world. And to see the Indian cities have their traditional foods kind of swept away by the junk food companies is one of the reasons why that 80.5% of Indian adults are overfat.
Let me throw this as a possible, not an answer, because I don't have any answers. But I'm going to throw this at you in my anthropological evolutionary paradigm, all right? So hunting and gathering isn't real easy. I mean, coming across something that's edible and holding it and eating it and feeding your family, I mean, that was hard work, and it wasn't predictable. But if you end up with a tree that is full of whatever and these sweet-tasting things, that would be a real find. So I think embedded in our DNA and our process pass forward, when we find something sweet like that, we hoard it. It's good. It's going to be short-lived. It's not going to be around forever. And I think the same program is operating in our firmware, in our brains, that says, oh, sweet, good, get it while we can. It's going to help sustain us. It's good energy. So we just go for it, find it. And you know what? Today, it's limitless. It's everywhere. I'm probably 100 feet from a source right now, and it's just everywhere.
Yeah, you're right. First of all, they didn't have those trees. Mm. The earliest fruits were not very sweet. And eventually, you know, they would maybe find a beehive that they would carefully, you know, get some honey from. But that was a, you know, once a year kind of thing. And there just weren't those foods around. But you're right. It took a lot of energy to survive. And a lot of that energy could not come from glycogen, because it's so limited. We had to get it from fat. Humans were fat burners, very effective fat burners. The sweet taste that you were referring to is not something that happened until the agricultural revolution. I mean, those fruits, what became fruits, were not that sweet. They gradually got more and more sweet. But once people started fiddling around with fruit, which is what happened in, you know, during the agricultural revolution, among other things, just hand picking. So, oh, here's an apple tree. This apple tree is much sweeter than that one. I'm going to only grow new trees from that fruit. And that was a big factor, but it just was not significant. And once industry came in, and once people started selling you something, then the sweet thing was a big factor. I mean, by the time I was growing up as a kid, every kitchen in the neighborhood had a huge pail of white flour and another huge pail of white sugar. And you can get a free Betty Crocker cookbook if you call, you know, and in it, it'll say, everything you make, add sugar and flour.
Right.
I want to put this in there, because as you're saying that, I remember my grandmother's house in the kitchen, the biggest drawers. In fact, it was not a drawer. It was a cupboard that tilted outward. Mm. And it was probably 2 feet tall, and it had, I bet you, at least 10, 15, maybe 20 pounds of flour and sugar in each of those. So you're right.
Yeah. What happens with people when you say, well, here's what junk food is, and there's another article on my website called What is Junk Food? And it kind of goes through this. But when you say, you know, you're probably eating a lot of sugar, they say, oh, I don't eat any sugar. And I could guarantee you, because I've done this, if I go through your cupboard and your refrigerator, I will find 3/4 of the things that are in there have sugar. It says right on the label. There's a lot of different forms of sugar, but it'll say, you know, sucrose or sugar, cane sugar, corn syrup, whatever. They put it in everything.
Dr. Maffetone, I need at least 2 hours for you to give me warning that you're coming over, okay? Because I've got some work to do. And to your point, Scott, your grandmother had these things. So you're a small child and you're eating grandmother's cooking and it's so good and it feels comforting and it's safety and it's childhood memory stuff. It's hard for us to push that away. So when we're in the busy day, we're trying to get to work, we're getting on a subway, we go by the bakery effect might be also the grandmother effect, sure. Right? It's nice to have a taste of grandma in your hand as you're going off to work in the modern world. That's another thing to battle. It makes me feel comfort food.
It's comfort food. The fact is it's sedating food because it sedates your brain. If that's comfortable, okay, as long as you don't go and try to do some work, operate machinery, drive a vehicle, have a business meeting. You know, you go into a business meeting, you go into a conference room, you're going to have a big meeting. What do you see on the table?
Donuts.
Bowls of candy.
Yeah.
You go to your dentist. Most dentists have bowls of candy. I'm so offended when I see that. It's like, how could they do this? But it's our culture, worldwide culture that has been evolving for all of our lives and our parents' lives, our grandparents' lives. And way back.
A part of your article you bring up and you have a subtitled, Our Athletic Origin. We started out as foragers, hunters and gatherers. And then you say, recently there's been big changes. And I'll just, because I wrote it down and I'm going to plagiarize right from you, that their agricultural industry has been around for 350 generations. And we just spoke about that. And I was under the impression that apple trees, pear trees, orange trees were just growing around out there and decided to bring themselves up. But in fact, they were genetically altered early on, I guess. And then we started to plant them in rows and feed them water and fertilizer. And now fruit is everywhere. And it's unlike we've ever had before. I didn't realize that. So thank you for that. That industry's been around, industrial has been around for about 7 generations, and then now digitally for 2 generations. That the world is different than we were living some generations ago, over 350 generations ago. And so when I read that, I thought to myself, we are much like a caged, I think about like a wild animal, like a lion that's at the zoo in a cage. We were built to be roaming out there like that lion was, but really we're just caged animals being fed different things that really our bodies weren't engineered for. And that's a crisis, I think.
Somebody actually brings the food to your little door, your cage, at specific times every day, right?
Yeah. Sometimes they pick out the food.
Right.
But if you pick it out, it's because you heard an advertisement. You know, I mean, I don't know if you guys remember the drive-in movies where you'd go with a car and they'd have this big screen and you'd look and they would have these like little blips of junk food that would come and go. You hardly recognize, and it caused people to get up and go buy junk food. Nothing new. Marketing has been deceiving people for thousands of years. And the junk food industry, very much like the tobacco industry, gets their way. You know, the U.S. government subsidizes junk food. How in the world can we fix things, not just here, but around the world? How can we fix things when the government's in bed with these companies? I have an answer to my question, which is that we as individuals have to take charge. And that's, you know, it's a jungle out there. And we need to get through this jungle on this trail in one piece. And the more we understand what we're up against, the more we can do it successfully.
Let me ask this question, Dr. Maffetone. Become a dietitian for a 24-hour period. And what should I eat for breakfast? Tell me what a lunch should look like in a dinner in a world that's closer to how we should, maybe perhaps how you eat on a good day.
Yeah. And of course, the answer is that, you know, it should be personalized to your particular needs. So, you know, you go through this 2-week test and you realize what one of the goals of the 2-week test is, that you realize that you're gonna have an apple. After the 2 weeks, you're gonna put some natural foods back every other meal, so you avoid that 2-meal effect. And you think, okay, well, I'm gonna have a small apple. And all of a sudden, you get indigestion, which you hadn't had now in 2 weeks. You get a little sleepy because you had it after lunch. And you even though it's natural, you say, well, okay, there's certain natural carbohydrates I can't eat anymore. So whatever a good day's menu would be is going to vary from person to person, but I can give you some sure. examples. I don't know if we've talked about it or not, but I have a whole series of articles on caffeine and fat burning, and I have a whole menu called Phil's Fat Burning Coffee. And these are recipes that you can add to your coffee in the morning, which for me is actually my breakfast. So in the morning, I put an egg, a whole egg, coconut oil, and some heavy cream. And when the coffee's ready, I put a little bit in there so that it blends up well. And it's the best cappuccino you've ever had. You're getting 300 or 400 calories. That's your breakfast. It's a healthy breakfast. It revs up the metabolism because you've got all this healthy fat. And sometime later in the morning, I have an omelet, maybe 3 or 4 eggs, a bunch of vegetables. And then whenever early afternoon, I may have a salad with some meat or cheese or both. And then for dinner, which is the lightest meal, just maybe some blueberries, fresh blueberries with heavy cream, or fresh blueberries with some fermented dairy like sour cream. And that's it. What's nice is that when you get off carbohydrates, your caloric needs go down. And what a deal that is, because for years, we've talked about this whole thing of, you know, how can we affect aging? How can we slow the aging process down? How can we age better? And the studies with beginning with rodents that have gone through monkeys, and some are being used, not the same way with humans, but in terms of measuring the antioxidant system and other things that where they can measure aging. The only thing we found out in terms of lifestyles, to eat less food. You eat less food, you age better. Well, first of all, that's no fun, because now you're starving yourself. It's like the fasting idea. Fasting is this wonderful thing. Let's get up in the morning and not eat for 7 or 8 hours. Meanwhile, you're a crank and nobody likes you anymore. You know, how can we maintain our energy? We have to, the game is, we don't want to reduce our calories at the expense of nutrients. Well, if you have a really improved metabolism, you may have less requirement for those nutrients. So now it's conceivable that your caloric intake, your requirements go down 30%, because now you're in ketosis, because now you're in this amazing fat burning situation. And so that's a way to control aging. And when we eat carbohydrates, of course, we have the insulin effect, which makes us hungry, and we tend to be, you know, it's like that old joke about Chinese food. You eat a whole bunch of it, you're full, and then you're hungry an hour later. That's what sugar does. That's what carbohydrates do, processed carbohydrates, and most of them are processed. And that leaves you with this really interesting symptom of hunger. Fatigue is a very important one too, but hunger is a great way to guide yourself through figuring out how best to eat for your needs. You want to get to the point where you're really not hungry anymore. You want to have a satiety. You want to have a metabolism that keeps the fats burning, so that we don't have to eat every 2 hours.
Much like a campfire, right? You just constantly kind of add to keep it going. You don't throw a big bunch of flammable material on it every once in a while. goes into a huge flame. This is my metaphor for carbohydrates, simple sugars, but you just want to keep it slowly burning throughout the day through the method you just talked about.
Yes, it's a good analogy. You get the quick burn from the smaller sticks and then the long burning log that gives you heat all night.
Phil, before we finish in the last few minutes, I want to hit on another very important part of the article that you wrote with Paul Larson that we're featuring. It'll be in the show notes, called Athletes Fit But Unhealthy. There's really two ways to be unhealthy. One is diet, which we focused quite a bit on. And the other one that you, with Paul, bring up in the article is maybe we are overtraining or running too much, too fast, too hard. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a big problem because the trend, and again, going back to the running boom, you know, in the 70s, or these crazy people that were going to run these long distances. And the idea was that, you know, we came up with all these sayings. You've got to train fast to race fast. And a lot of that came from track and field coaches who, you know, when they retired, or, I mean, track and field is, it's one of my fun sports, but it's not very big. So when the running boom comes along and there's explosion of all these runners, the coaches over in track and field say, I'm going to go over there and coach. And when they did, they brought their track and field work ethic with them, which was you run fast because you've got to race fast. And then there was the no pain, no gain thing, which actually started with Benjamin Franklin, but that was a mantra in the running world. And, you know, it basically, more is better. And the thing we touched on in the beginning, which was, you know, I could eat whatever I want because if I eat too much of something, I just run an extra mile or two. Wow, where did that mentality come from? We've been dumbed down so much as a society that we don't know the simple basic things of our bodies, certainly, and of life. So I would say, and I take the overtraining definition in a real big picture format. If we look at Hans Selye, who described stress 100 years ago, he coined the word stress, and he talked about how the hypothalamus and the pituitary and the adrenal glands worked to monitor and regulate our stress and adapt to stress. And he talked about the different kinds of stresses. And he said there was physical stress, biochemical stress, I'm paraphrasing, and mental emotional stress. So we've got these three categories of stress, which most people can't even relate to, because when you mention the word stress, they think mental, emotional stress. But wearing bad shoes is a huge stress. And this whole dietary thing we talked about is a huge metabolic, you know, a biochemical stress. So what overtraining is really is when that whole balance is distorted. I categorize stress in three phases. The first phase is the initial onset of overtraining, which we can recover from in a day or two. And if we don't recover from it, then we accumulate more stress. The adrenals continually get revved up. We keep dumping out stress hormones to try and adapt. We never really recover from day to day. So there's an accumulation of stress. But during that first phase of overtraining, we don't think so much about it. We get sore. But if we wake up the next day and we go for a workout and we're sore anyway, that's a clue that we're overtraining. So we need more time off. But what's interesting about the early stage of overtraining is sometimes we perform a personal best out of the blue. And that's a classic first sign of overtraining. And the reason we do that is because that first sign of overtraining is accompanied by an increase in sympathetic activity. Our autonomic nervous system gets out of balance. We have more sympathetic activity, so we're stronger. It's artificial because our hormones are making us stronger, like the mother who lifts up a car because her kid's underneath. And of course, the parasympathetics were down, so our gut gets trashed. But I ran a 10K PR by 2 minutes. well, that is dangerous. Instead of thinking, well, that might be dangerous, people say, oh, I should keep training what I'm doing because I'm the greatest. And then it's not until that second stage of overtraining when we start getting fatigued, we wake up, we kind of feel, yeah, this is not so great. We get sleep impairment, we're tired, we're hungry. Then we start getting the relatively minor injuries. It's not until the third stage where people tend to say, oh, yeah, that's what overtraining is. Well, it's the end stage of overtraining where people are seriously ill. And a lot of athletes who get into that third stage don't ever come back. They're the ones that retire. And we've all known, you know, young, healthy, great runners who were forced to retire at a, you know, too young of an age. Just think about the running magazines and who was on the cover. Of course, now they have models on the cover. You know, whatever happened to so-and-so, you know, they're gone.
That's interesting.
So overtraining is a full spectrum that we need to look at. And, you know, we can also overtrain in some unusual ways. We could have the perfect training schedule, but if we're eating bad, we could be overtraining. Also, here's the perfect schedule. Oh, I got the perfect schedule because it was written about in a running magazine. It must be perfect. They would never lie. The fact is now you've got this perfect schedule, but you didn't consider the rest of your life. Well, I've got a family. I've got three kids. I've got a house. I've got these social things I need to do. I work 60 hours a week. Oh, I could, you know, I'll wake up early to get my runs in. You know, that doesn't work.
When it comes down to it, I want to come back to what you said at the very beginning of the podcast. It should be fun and you should look forward to those workouts. If you're getting up and you're tired and you're worn out and you're fatigued and you're thinking, oh, I got to get out there and run today because it's on my spreadsheet. That's a sign that you're overtraining or unhealthy.
Yeah, sure, exactly. And, you know, the idea that we're, you know, we're like Rocky, we're going to go train somewhere and be miserable, loneliness of the long distance runner, we're training ourselves into the ground so we can get better. You know, it's there's the social issues are really something that always needs to be considered. We need to step back. And it's a reason for having a coach because someone can look at what you're doing objectively. But you've got family members, you know, who often will say, you know, maybe getting up at 4 o'clock to do your run isn't a good idea. You don't go to bed till 11. Do you think? Oh, no, I'm a runner. I'm a runner.
So I've got one final question for you because you hit on it on your last discussion point there about the adrenals. You know, I had a friend that was a triathlete and he happened to be at the top of the game and all of a sudden he fell off. And the diagnosis or the speculation was, well, he burnt through his adrenals or he had adrenal problems. And that was just kind of the thought of the day or his, what they felt happened to him. Can you speak a little bit about that? Because you talked about the adrenals picking up and giving you a personal best and kind of carrying you and misleading you, thinking you're on the right track. And you probably keep going to the well, the adrenals, to kind of keep you there. And at some point, kind of like diabetes type 2, where you wear out your islets of Langerhans. Is that the name of the cells in the pancreas?
Yeah, you burn out your pancreas, literally.
Yeah, so can you burn out your adrenals trying to keep up and then find yourself just
sure
out of sorts for full definition?
Yeah, sure. Burnout is a common problem. It's a common problem in the corporate world, in the world of education. In professions, as you know, doctors who are working long hours or, you know, when you're still a student, you know, it's insane. School is insane at that professional level. So just back up a bit. So when our brain senses stress, our brain at that level of the hypothalamus tells the pituitary, we've got some stress and I want you to tell the adrenals how to adapt to them. Now we have the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis is one axis. We have one like the thyroid instead of the adrenal and the ovaries. But the adrenals are the big one. the adrenals respond to the stress by making more stress hormone. And when the stress continues and we don't adapt and we don't pay attention to the signs and symptoms, the adrenals keep making more stress hormone. Among the things that happens, stress hormone goes up and all the other hormones go down. That's not a good thing to do. They then become the reason for certain symptoms. But then if the stress continues in the second stage of overtraining, for example, the adrenals can't keep up with this production of stress hormones. And so what happens is the adrenal gland literally gets larger. It goes through a state of hypertrophy. The gland gets bigger so it can make more stress hormones, just what you need. And now by the third stage of overtraining, the adrenals can't keep up and it literally stops working well. You are now in a state of disease. And it's like I said before, it's a serious problem. And it's the reason why many people who get into that third state get well entrenched in it. The adrenals become so impaired that it's now a pathology. And you can't recover from that. But along the way, you've got all these things. You've got the hormones bouncing around, adapting. And, you know, the adrenal is an endpoint in this process. And like we talked about before, we've got to look at what are the primary things. So we got to backtrack that up to the pituitary and up to the brain. So we're back to the brain as the most important part of a runner's body. You know, what's happening here? I'm going to think about this. What's happening? I never had any of these injuries, and all of a sudden, the last year, I've had 12. Do you think that's normal? This is a big part, and I know we're not talking about this, but this is a reason to monitor your heart rate, because all along the way, but if your exercise heart rate gets worse, your running heart rate is higher at the same pace, or your pace is slower at the same heart rate, that means you're going the wrong way. So all you have to do is monitor yourself. Don't take my word for it. Listen to your body.
Dr. Maffetone, we always learn so much. We never know where we're going to go. Coming into your classroom unprepared is the best way to show up. Just be open, receptive, and curious, and you're going to learn something. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I never know what's going to happen on these shows either, but it's always fun, which is like we talked about. That's so important. Have fun. Please have fun. Have fun eating. Have fun training. If you race, have fun racing. That's what life is all about.
Yep.
Dr. Maffetone, you're a thought leader, and you've led a lot of us in a positive direction, and we hope to keep following because you're guiding us in the right place, I think.
I appreciate it, and thanks again for having me.
Excellent. So go out and train and be healthy.
Mas. Hey, Scott, a trail race doesn't happen on its own, and a podcast doesn't happen on its own either.
No, we need to thank all those that provide and help us produce this good content. We want to thank the Patreon supporters. We really appreciate your contributions. The small aid that you make every month to help us improve on what we're trying to do here.
We would like to thank our business Patreon sponsor, Doug Crumley, a private wealth advisor with Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC. When you have the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Visit them at www.dougcrumleyjr.com. That's DougCrumleyJr.com.
We want to thank our producer, Doug Mayer.
We'd also like to thank sound man Ryan, who's with every episode and making sure that we're keeping on course.
And editing all of the bad stuff out, keeping the good stuff in. He's turning really all of our 3-hour podcasts into less than an hour podcast. That's 2/3 of the crap we say gets edited out. And a new addition is Yana Gibalova, who is our social media czar. You may be seeing some really cool social media content coming out. And she's responsible for that. Don and I don't even know how to log into those social media accounts, much less provide good content. And she's there to help us out. She's an active trail runner also, and we're glad that she's on board.
Come down to my place when you are.